Okay, thank you very much, Glenn. That was great. We all kind of, oh, you've been shamed into coming to the front. Good work, Charles. Okay. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to give my responses to Glenn's presentation, and then we're going to throw the questions open to everybody else. Okay, there are a few things, but something at the beginning of your presentation, when you talked about your upbringing and being Stoke, so there's something about that. I happened to be going to Nottingham earlier, and in the car I listened to Radio 4 Women's Hour, and there was Marina Abramovic, the performance artist, was on there doing her thing, but she said a line that stuck with me all day, and she said something about, in her way that she does, if you're familiar with her work, which I'm sure you are, that the harder your life is, the better artist you are. So I'm just interested in something about what you think about how much artists are shaped by their upbringing. So that's the one point. And again, that there was a, I was, there's a few things, but there, I'm trying to frame it in a way that is helpful. So there's something about artists performing different roles, different identities. So there's things like artists performing participant observers, artists performing the social sociologist or social researcher, and artists as artists as a survivalist, artists as a scientist. So I'm quite interested in about what you think, what does an artist bring to those roles?
Okay, so the first point is, I think this is a personal point. I should say at this point, but I'm talking about Anna at this stage,
yeah.
So at least you for my own. She may have said that. I think it's easier to be successful as an artist if you're from a privileged background. I don't think it's impossible to be successful if you're not. It just seems that the successful artists have some advantages in life, in their childhood, but I may be wrong. I do think that it's for me anyway, it's easier to respond to situations that aren't perfect or beautiful. There's space there to make change, which is important for me. What's the point of changing utopia? You know, it's the dystopic that attracts me. I find beauty in the downtrodden and downhill. And so for me, the post-industrial nature of soap was really beguiling. Beyond the point where it got to, there's almost, I think there's a term used, degeneration porn or something like that, you know, where people were just seeking out the decrepit and the failing. And I think that's what I tried to allude to at the start of my talk. It stopped being enough just documenting. There had to be, you know, it's easy to say that's great, that's crap. If it's crap, you know, what can you do to make it better?
Do you think that's that artist there is? Does art always have to have that function?
For me, it does.
Yeah.
And I think actually it's probably the prevalent discourse in art at the moment is about use and function. And for me, it does. I don't think it has to. I think it's perfectly okay to be a Garrick style artist who is painting their insides or something, you know.
I suppose that had met up a bit, so function might have been the wrong word, so I think all art should have a function, but maybe does it need to affect social and political change?
I think for me.
Yeah.
And I think art's a so well placed to do it, you know. My colleague at Airspace often talks about artists, Anna Francis, she talks about artists being able to find gaps. And to find the gaps in a really creative way that city planners, town planners, authorities can't. And find the gaps, respond to them, suggest possible solutions, or, you know, just just portraying another way to go about the situation. And then, you know, largely it's up to the stakeholders or the decision makers to decide whether that's the way they want to go. But artists are really brilliant at finding the gaps and suggesting ways to close it.
Just before the last thing, I was interested in the Dark the Dark Mountain Manifesto, and this idea of just thinking about, for me, because I'm interested in the whole kind of a-human, post-human work as well, so it all fits into that thinking. But I just wondered what if it did get to the point where your survivalist strategies were what was left, would we still need artists?
Yeah, because you'd need those creative solutions to really difficult problems. You know, I think the ability to see those things that aren't immediately seeable is part of what we're good at as a group of people. I think something I want to say about the Dark Mountain thing, and I think one thing that happened at site whilst we were there was we had a guy come in and tell us that we were all doomed, that it didn't matter what we did, the world's been around 20 years, no, he was quite specific, 20 years. And he started off attacking us for creating some false hope in people through this activity. And by the end of the conversation, we'd talked him around and we agreed that he would pretend to people that there was some hope, although he still thought we were doomed. Because why shut people down? And, you know, what happened if in 20 years and one day everything was still there? You know? And the Dark Mountain thing does come from this part of this group that thinks that we are doomed. And that's really dangerous, you know, and probably not true. And anyway, even if it is, it's not a reason to stop doing a bit. Each of us do a little bit that helps, then that's not a bad thing. And I think if we all understood the land a little bit more and made a little change in our lives, that would be super helpful.
Helpful to humans or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And humans as a part of the ecological system of life on this planet. You know? We're only a part of it, but we're, you know, we can control what we do.
I'm going to throw it open now to other people. Oh, Jean's got the mic.
The lady with the mic.
This is my question.
It's less or less.
Well, let's wait and see.
Yes. I really like your site residency, by the way. This is a way of prefacing my question. I just want you you made an interesting point about the kind of evangelism around certain kinds of ways of living, ecology, and so forth. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about perhaps there is a romanticization around not just that way of living, if it were in fact possible, but also perhaps a romanticization about certain kinds of art practices. I'm not really involved in this, but certain kinds of art practices that might deal with such things. And I mean, I was thinking about the fact that, say, for instance, one of the great enablers of feminism has been the invention of electricity, you know, fridges and so forth, washing machines. And I know Douglas from Dark Mountain a little bit, and he spends a lot of time on planes going from one kind of, you know, I mean, one project, one worthy project to another around the world. So I think it's very problematic, so I don't want to be like the man who comes in and says, you know, why are you doing this? Because it's all pointless. And I don't think it's pointless, but I think there is an issue around the romanticisation of, and I was brought up on a farm, so it's quite brutal. The business of feeding people is quite brutal. How you tackle that in your practice so that it then is properly political with a small
team? There is a bit of a point there. Just mentioned that the practice of feeding people is brutal. Well, stop feeding them, let people feed themselves. And I don't, and when I say that, I know exactly that that is unlikely to happen at the position that we're in now, but we've given that away. You know, we've given our ability to feed ourselves, to understand how to feed ourselves, away to industrial farmers and corporate markets.
Can I just interject and I'll give the mic back? I think if you looked at pre-industrial farming, then probably the business of feeding oneself was even more brutal.
Absolutely. And you're right to bring in this notion of romanticism, because I think the reason that farming became important was because people were interested in living longer, and you know, life expectancy being short is a natural outcome of living a solo nomadic existence, I guess, you know, without this sense of cooperation. I think it's something I would say, though, that once we started farming, as I mentioned, then we did start the beginnings of what has become a capitalist society, and notions of value and worth and merit are all pretty much bound up in that. On your romantic point, absolutely, definitely right. You know, I think when we're carrying this activity out, we both know how reliant we are on our digital cameras and our mobile phones, and all those areas of our life that we can't give up, like we're addicted to it through daily use, or we're not knowledgeable enough how to live without those things. I just say that that's not a reason to not know stuff.
No, I'm not saying
you were, but that this is where we're coming from, that not knowing those things is not a reason for not trying to know those things, if you know what I mean. So I'm quite happy to relearn or find out lots of things that I've never known how to do, and I've been happy up until now to have people do for me, it seems like a good way to go about continuing to understand my own particular place on this planet.
Is there something about, because I share some of this about my own practice actually, about thinking about how authentic, also is it a question of authenticity, or I mean, I think it's something about if you're an artist and in academia that you might practice in a certain way or do research in a certain way, and there's this kind of dissonance between your practice or your research and how you live your everyday life. Is that something, you know, is there something in that, you know, is it okay that artists come in and just pick up an issue or pick up and say and do it for a time and then go back to, you know, non-living off the, you know, going back to shopping at Tesco's and stuff. Is that all right?
I think it's important for me not to be purely playing.
Yeah.
I do know the value of play within artistic practice, but I think authenticity is good. It's hard to be 100% authentic at the time, you know, but I think that's quite important.
I thought of something really interesting when you were saying about not knowing the trees, and then with the question that was just asked, and I can't remember where I saw this, but I saw something where these children were asked where milk came from, and they said Tesco. And this kind of, this thought that a lot of this stuff is lost, and I think it's that we're quite separated from what we eat and things like that, and acknowledging that that was once a living animal or that sort of thing. And I thought that was quite interesting in your work in a way of educating people back to this stuff that's lost.
Absolutely, but I should, that comes with a caveat. You know, I don't kill my own meat, but I eat meat from the supermarket. You know, there's a lack of authenticity there, you know. I eat less meat than I did, but yeah, I don't think we're trying to educate people, but we are trying to to be a channel that information can pass through. And my aspiration is to live a better, cleaner, more knowledgeable existence. I'm not great at it, but I'm trying every day.
Yeah.
And if we all did, if we all have more knowledge about where the world comes from.
There's a saying that I quite like. It said, "Be the change you want to see in the world." I think that kind of really
leads to
what you were saying. Thank you.
And also the introduction to your second question about the role of the artist. There are other organisations and people with overlapping concerns who also, and I'm sure you know more about it than I do, but the transition movement or the abundance in Sheffield, you go foraging and make jam, that sort of thing. So I'd be really interested to hear you talk some more about how what you do comes from. You alluded to that sort of artistic logic or way of thinking or sort of foundation to what you do. So although you've got sort of overlapping environmental concerns and some overlapping techniques, you're coming at it from a different sort of theoretical and aesthetic basis to do with that feedback loop you were talking about. So I'd like to hear you talk more about how you would distinguish your practice from those other environmental movements that don't come from that sort of artistic theoretical grounding?
That's a tough one. I think there's no infrastructure within the arts to act professionally in that sense. So often we are acting independently, I think. From our own concerns. The other thing I'd say is that we, as artists, we are really good cross-disciplinary practitioners. I think we can draw from lots of different standpoints and activate those independently of any work structure. So I think our difference might be in our independence approach, and that's that we can offer solutions that maybe don't come from the considered ways of working or particular professions or certain overarching theories. I think we're particularly well placed to mix and match. I think mostly to be independent of authoritative bodies.
Thank you.
Your next round.
Hey. I was really interested in when you did the Rose Garden. And I've been really interested in this idea of today we have all these new buildings and industrial direction seems to be more to do with building and deforestation, etc. And this idea of using to create spaces for nature and they're very controlled, just like the garden seems to be. So I was just wondering, would you consider it to be a success if in the future we just had all buildings but there wasn't sparse areas that were controlled areas of beautiful nature and no real wildlife anymore? Would that still be a success or
that doesn't sound like successful
doesn't
say that,
just wondering.
No, I think I really believe that our city centres need to change their purpose, or people in control of the city centres need to change their vision, and wild space within, there seems to be a natural disinclination for wildness in any form, whether that's for humans or plants. I mean, I think it's okay to have things that aren't governed. Humans do. The brownfield spaces in my city are so beautiful, so successful. You know, underneath, there's still got the remnants of the activity that happened before, whether that be shop or factory. But growing through those cracks, and we saw it on the site just by Quickford, the little cracks create fertile ground that nature grabs hold of and does it really successfully. And I think we could really learn quite a bit from that. Also, it's important for students to learn some of
that. The thing with that, though, is even though we do have these wild spaces, there still tend to be. I remember watching this documentary of this forest that was actually, without human intervention, all these plants that were on the ground would not exist. And this idea of the more we seem to get involved in these like forests and wildlife, is it really a real forest anymore, or if we went there, would these plants be there, would we still want to visit it because it didn't look as beautiful as we cultivated it to be?
I think it's really interesting. maybe we don't understand our destructive power even when they try to act as a force of the other, you know. So, yeah, I'd quite be seeing the size left.
Thank you.
When my son was very small and at Metairie School in Paris, kids were taken out to a farm in the country to see animals. And the next day, they went back to school and he came back with a drawing. They'd all been given drawings of pigs and cows, and they'd all marked out meat on it, chops, sirloin, neck, collar, the tasty things that you could make of them. But there is no nature without culture. Culture produces nature. We don't even know what wildness is. My real question is about sight, though. I really completely concede your idea of placemaking. When it moves to a gallery, I begin to have some problem with it.
Me too.
You too, clearly. Because the strategies you're describing in the project inside the research and development, the buildings of shelters, the finding of food. These are all things that the Zadists are using at the moment, as we speak, on the zone, outside Nantes, where there have been 10 years of occupation to stop an airport being built there.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a real struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when it moves in to a gallery? What exactly are we fighting for there? In our occupation of space.
I think it's really powerful. I've been spending 10 years trying to escape the gallery whilst at the same time running a gallery. I don't know the answer to that. Sorry. I quite like going to galleries to look at things. It's a good place to find different information than you get in museums, and it's a good place for artists who I already have described think a little differently, so to see ideas that come from the sidelines or from sideways and laterally, they're good places to see those ideas presented. So I'm really not against it, and I think they're good places to go and see those ideas. I definitely prefer working in situation. Some site specific is really important to me. So. There's something really harsh about white walls. They have a place. I don't know if that answers your question. It's a very good question.
I think it's a question that doesn't really have a very possible, it's not one that's possible to answer. It's the question that people working as activists are always posing. It may be that we're a multiplicity of subjects, that the point of being an activist is not be foremost an artist. That's something else that you do as well as all the things that
I think that's another really possible area for the artists to operate. Artists as actors or artists is definitely a place for it. I wonder if sometimes it's the tragedy of the artist is that there are too many possibilities. You know, how do we narrow ourselves down? Should we?
Yeah, we have got 4 minutes.
It was just an add-on to that as why you prefer to be site specific. Is that maybe because the audience that you get from your site specific work is maybe more of the general culture, as the audience that might go into the gallery would maybe be a smaller segment of society?
Well, working as a gallerist in a northern provincial city is a constant battle to get people to cross the threshold of the gallery and come in and engage with works, and I get a lot more satisfaction from taking the works out into the public space where people can respond to them on their own terms, at their own leisure, in their own way, without feeling cowed by that wolf. Authority of the museum space and the gallery space. So yeah, that's definitely one of the reasons. But also the sun that shines in the gallery has.
Well, I come from Doncaster, not far away from here. Okay.
Yeah, galleries.
We've got a couple.
We're going to water.
But
Kill
the
time.
They have got one of the Dark Mountain, one of the current Dark Mountain.
Okay.
But it was surprising, so I was talking to some of the students at Doncaster College and I was saying to them, oh, you should get to the museum at Edinburgh. They'd lived in Doncaster all their lives and they had no idea that we even had one and that we had an art gallery in the museum. And I think probably what you were saying about Stoke and things like that, the probably seems to the matter that people don't know it's there.
Sure, I should say that I firmly believe that there needs to be a healthy, thriving contemporary in any successful location, and part of that would be a contemporary art gallery. And yeah, I guess, they're hard places to go into, I guess, for anybody who works in them, it's our job to make it easier without going down.
Idea of a gallery, I was actually discussing with a friend the other day about maybe breaking down what that is, and maybe if you're doing lots of work with nature, it kind of occurred to me, why not be in that environment directly and getting people from a building that is a gallery and bringing them out into that place where they really feel that they are involved, because I think seeing, like if you had all those workshops and things in the garden, for example, people being able to make that connection more obvious rather than in a gallery. Sometimes there have been plenty of times where I've come in and looked at a piece of work and it's just gone completely over my head because there's no information on it, nothing. And the artist expects us to take, what they've shown and like we should know and understand it, but there are no lack of
options. Sorry, it's not the artist isn't thinking that. I think what the artist might be expecting is that you get involved in the process of looking and have an opinion and have a feeling and maybe leave the gallery and go and do some further research afterwards. And I think that's a fair relationship between the two. I think the artist put a load of and the curator put a load of work into showing the work, and I think it's the audience's responsibility to engage with the work either positively or negatively,
and not expect to be spoon-fed by the institution. I think it is tough sometimes to think that you need to understand what's being said, but there are no right or wrong answers. You are entitled to feel or choose to feel whatever you get from an artwork. I think, you know, there's some individual responsibility in how you approach that. And it doesn't matter if you don't get it, it doesn't matter if you don't like it, but you should have a feeling or an opinion on the subject.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. That's, I think we're done. Thank you very much.
There are a lot of survey scenes, there's some postcards that are free.